You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Hi, folks. Be sure to visit my webpage at dr-history.com for over 440 true stories of the Old West. Also, now available on Amazon, my first book, a historical fiction based on true events entitled Coal Miner to Cowboy. The story of a young man born in England in 1850. He wants to be a cowboy and makes his way to America, travels from New Orleans to Independence on a steamboat, hires on as a teamster to Santa Fe, then on a cattle drive to Bozeman, Montana. He also rides shotgun on a stagecoach. He travels with a wagon train, and on his two-year journey, he meets some famous people and keeps a journal of his adventures. The book contains a lot of the true stories from my podcast and is now available on Amazon. Visit my webpage for a link to Amazon for the book, Coal Miner to Cowboy.
And right now, we have most of his entourage seated with comfy chairs, and they've rolled out the red carpet for him. And here he is, fresh from quite a few speeches last weekend, Dr. History.
Good morning, Zeb.
How are you?
I'm doing good.
What are we going to talk about this morning?
Okay, we started last week. We're talking mainly the subject is the Europeans that came over here to see what it was like, and then they wrote back to the people in England and France and Germany and all about what it's like here, and which caused a lot of them to actually immigrate over to help settle the West.
Really?
And a lot of what they wrote also inspired the Easterners to head west. So not just the Europeans, but their writings were used quite a bit by even the ones that were already here.
You just touched on a subject that I was going to ask you about. The Easterners, you just referred to them as, along the East Coast, those that never listened to the words, go west, young man.
Right.
What was the attitude of those people, that the West was just nothing but a bunch of wild renegades and they were above it, or what?
Not necessarily they were above it. I think it was maybe fear.
Really?
Of heading out to where they didn't know what was out here. They heard stories about the Indians. They heard about the deserts and the difficulty, the snow. And so I think these people that wrote about it told what it was like, to where it enticed a lot of people to head out on the Oregon Trail.
But you will admit that there were probably a lot of people that looked at the Daniel Boones and the Davy Crockett's and the Kit Carsons and everything as, those wild renegades.
Yeah. And that, there was a certain amount of fear.
Yeah.
You know? So, last week I started telling you about Sir Richard Burton.
Yeah. Not Elizabeth's husband.
Not.
No.
Sir Richard Burton, he came over and he wanted to see what things were like. And I mentioned last week that, he had a pretty good arsenal of guns. And,
yeah.
And then he discussed the art of Western gunslinging. You remember he talked.
He was the guy who was afraid that he was going to shoot himself in the foot.
He was. And he talked about how that works. And he also confessed that he was hoping that the military officers would enjoy having a real, genuine British soldier to help them out with the problems with the Indians.
Didn't he remember and realize that we, as patriots, kicked his butt?
Continuing on. So here he is. He's getting ready to head out. Okay. So by the time all of his gear was assembled, Burton had found that the local mint juleps were quite delicious, and that he was reluctant to leave St. Joseph because he quite enjoyed that drink. Well, he finally boarded a westbound stagecoach and made acquaintance with the, quote, traditionally familiar feature of the chuck holes in the roads.
Really?
He says, quote, which render traveling over the prairies at times a sore task.
To me, it would seem like these English or these Brits would be just so refined that they wouldn't want to go.
And some were.
Yeah.
A little bit uppity up.
Yeah.
So anyway, for potential immigrants, he carefully worked up a mile-by-mile, day-by-day itinerary from St. Joseph to Salt Lake City. He interrogated fellow passengers and calculated that a wagon party of six would require, among other things, two yoke of oxen, a milk cow, 24 pounds of raisins, and a bushel of dried beans, the cost of that being about exactly $490.98.
Go back to the raisins. I'm confused.
24
Why?
Pounds
Why
of raisins.
Why were they so important?
I don't know. That was his idea of necessities. 24 pounds of raisins.
I can think of a lot of things, not raisins.
I agree. So Burton's stagecoach traveled along the Platte River, one of several routes then under consideration for a transcontinental railroad. And since Sir Richard was aware that British capitalists were interested in investing in the railroad, he pointed out that the Valley of the Platte, quote, offer a route scarcely to be surpassed for natural gradients. In other words, he actually could see that, okay, this could be a very good route for a transcontinental railroad.
Really?
Sure. And of course, that's what happened. You know,
yeah.
It did do that,
yeah.
The transcontinental. So, you know, his appraisal of the route was right on the mark. Well, Sir Richard reached the great Salt Lake City and quickly discovered that the town was seriously lacking in several aspects.
Oh, in his opinion.
In his opinion. His hotel was short on servants and boot polish. And since the Mormons insisted on public temperance, he found no saloons and no mint juleps.
Oh, how did he live?
I don't know. And he says, quote, bottles and decanters were not forthcoming.
I see. So he was not used to having a dry society.
And without servants.
Very important, yes.
Yes. So Sir Richard left Salt Lake City. He never got a chance to fight Indians. He described the Great Sioux Nation as, quote, one of the most warlike and numerous in the U.S. territory. Unsurpassed in single combat on horseback, they are not, however, formidable warriors. He says they never attack when they should, and invariably they attack when they should not.
What kind of an entourage did he have with him?
Oh, you know, he had quite a few. Nothing like some of the bigger ones.
I mean, you said he packed up and left Salt Lake City. I mean, in my mind's eye, I've got a wagon train.
Yeah. I mean, he had, you know, probably 8 or 10 wagons.
Wow.
His guide, his cook, his servants, and whatever else, you know. Burton was actually fascinated by scalping. Scalping.
You're not talking about stealing tickets or anything.
Scalping.
Oh, my goodness.
And he called that a solemn rite. And after questioning various soldiers and settlers about the practice, he gave his readers a very accurate description of this operation.
I'm so glad you're doing this.
I don't know if I want to do that.
I'm questioning it.
Yeah, so I'm not going to go through there's a whole paragraph here on the art of scalping.
Let's leave where it was. Bless you, my child.
Yes, we're done with that. Anyway, Sir Richard could not resist passing some remarks on the quality of Western justice.
Uh-huh.
As the Westerners themselves admitted, their, quote, jerry-built version of the law and order left something to be desired.
I see.
We're talking, you know, about, you know, the justice that was carried out sometimes quickly and sometimes maybe not necessarily the way it should have been.
Yeah.
He talked about a guy that, in full view of everybody, shot at a guy to death in a town, and they went to trial, and he was acquitted because he happened to be a very popular person in town.
Oh.
And the judge approved of the verdict that he was not guilty.
I see.
And that happened on occasion.
Uh-huh.
So with his
kind of like what's going on today.
Yes. With his curiosity satisfied, Sir Richard returned to England in December of 1860, and there his book was published in 1861. And meanwhile, he got married and settled down, and he pretty much stayed in England, but would occasionally still come back because he had property here in America.
I was going to ask you, he decided all of a sudden to go back to England.
Yeah.
And you said he went back in December. How long did it take to get his entourage back from, where were they, in Wyoming, you said? Or?
Well, they probably ended up clear back east again.
No, I know, but
oh, yes.
From where?
Right, from Salt Lake to
goodness.
Part of the West. So
I wonder how long that took from going from the West all the way back to England.
All the way back. You know, it's got to have been 2 or 3 months.
That's what I thought, too. Yeah.
Well, of course, in May of 1869, the Transcontinental Railroad was complete, which ushered in the age of Western tourism. Now, you don't think of it as tourism, do you, really?
No.
Don't you think of it as just getting people out here?
Yeah.
So, anyway, with overland travel now reasonably swift, the prosperous, the rich, in other words, British, responded in droves, streaming into the great Western frontier. They generally agreed that the new sleeping cars were actually better than their coaches back home in England.
Really?
So they really were quite impressed with these sleeper cars that took them out.
Okay.
There's a guy named, he was kind of a sportsman named Charles Messiter. He complained that his hotel in Cheyenne, quote, contained only one room for men, in which there were 27 beds, each meant for two people per bed.
Not in my world.
He continues, you never knew who you were going to have as a companion. Very frequently, a half-drunken wagon driver who, before he got into bed, deposited a loaded revolver under the pillow.
Nope.
I think I'd have paid a little more just to have a bed to myself.
Oh, you got it. Yeah. You ever heard of a sleeping bag?
That's right. On the floor.
Yeah.
Well, the British discovered Colorado and started colonizing America all over again. In the last three decades of the century, there were so many Britons arriving in Colorado as settlers and investors, not to mention those who came as hunters and tourists, that the state was sometimes called England beyond the Missouri.
Really?
Now, I'd never
for Colorado.
Yeah.
I didn't
know
that.
Yeah. So the most obvious of Colorado's appeals to the English was its really good climate.
Mm-hmm.
Its Rocky Mountain air, declared the noted British traveler William Grome. He said, quote, was dry and sparkling as perhaps none other on the globe. It seemed to be composed not of one-fifth, but of five-fifths of oxygen. You feel that it is air which has never been breathed before. And he goes on and talks about, he said, this champagne atmosphere attracts many English sufferers from lung ailments and cured more than a few. In fact, the mortality rate was so low that Englishman Charles Russell asked a Coloradoan whether anyone died thereabouts. And I like this. The local guy said, very few. He said, they had to shoot a man a little farther west to give their cemetery a start.
You know, you brought up something right there. The language and the verbiage of those times was so formal.
Articulate.
And,
very formal.
They used a lot of the dictionary that we seem to have forgotten.
Yeah, and even the Westerners, you know, as we've talked. But the British were very formal British. Queen's English, they called it. So Colorado Springs, described by an Englishman as, quote, a charming big village, and it was the favorite resort of people who had tuberculosis.
Really?
Because of the atmosphere. And even had his own English magazine. Another Colorado attraction was the cattle business, and there were a lot of British that saw the economics of cattle raising as being irresistible. And the herds, could graze at no cost on public lands that had grass growing, you know, everywhere.
Yeah.
So this was amazing to them, because back in England, you had small plots of ground that had to be rented or owned. So
many of those people that you're talking about, the Brits, they went to Wyoming and started some big ranches.
There were a lot of ranches. So, you know, as this kind of news reached Britain, it kind of pricked up the ears of small farmers as well as the lords of great estates. And the farmers were attracted by reports that a single cowboy could handle 1,000 head of steers all by himself. Now, that might have been a little exaggeration. But the big stock raisers, already alarmed by the influx of cheap American beef, decided that it was wiser to join the Westerners than to compete with them. So they sent their sons to the High Plains, and we've talked about that a little bit, about the British sons that came over. And
They were dandies.
Interesting young men. Some of them really got a hold of it and did good.
But some were...
Not so good.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, they had plenty of money. So many young Englishmen took up ranching in Colorado during the 1870s that, according to a British visitor, they accounted for almost one cattle spread out of every three.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I didn't think they were that big in the cattle industry, but evidently they were.
Weren't they the ones that brought the Herefords over here?
Well, Herefords, Guernsey and Jersey are islands just off the British coast.
Yeah.
So those, of course, are dairy cows.
But the Hereford itself, I think they were the ones that introduced... Maybe I'm wrong. The first Hereford bull to come into this country, the Intermountain West.
Yeah, well, there's an area in England that's called Hereford.
Yeah, Hereford.
So, but when the typical class-conscious English gentleman settled down to ranching, he was immediately given a lesson in the etiquette of Western life.
Oh, here we go.
Cowboys, he learned, were rugged individuals who considered no man their master.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, a cowboy's not just going to take having a guy that is kind of uppity up and...
In other words, they wouldn't let someone tell them what to do.
Exactly. They might suggest.
Yeah. Meekly.
Yes. But English cattlemen were quick to give the ranchers, the ranch hands, the respect they demanded. They talked about the cowboy. He said, quote, he is in the main a loyal, long-enduring, hardworking fellow, grit to the backbone, and tough as whipcord. So they did respect the cowboy as a hardworking individual.
Can you imagine, though, these old cowboys with a 5 days stubble beard and tough as bark on a tree, and somebody comes up and says, pip, pip, cheerio, old boy.
You know, they probably had to just roll their eyes and say,
okay, here we go.
What do you want me to do?
Yeah, really.
But, you know, there was, a bit of... snobbery involved.
Yeah.
There's a gal named Isabel Randall who arrived in the West as the bride of a British cattleman and lived up in Montana and was initially very good to invite her American neighbors to her social functions. But she came to regret this generous gesture because her guest displayed the alarming habit of fraternizing with the household help. Mrs. Randall complained, quote, how can anyone keep servants in their place when the people whom we associate with invite them to their houses as equals?
Oh, my goodness.
So that probably didn't settle real good with the local ranchers' wives who were, you know, back then, everybody got together and helped each other. You had barn raisings.
Yeah.
You had
barbecues,
quilting bees.
Yeah.
Everybody got together to help each other out. And the so-called help, you were the help.
Yeah.
You know, so interesting that.
But they were basically acting like their servants were slaves.
In a way,
yeah.
But that comes from the British atmosphere back years and years and years ago.
Yeah.
But that soon changed. I mean, the British that came over here, you know, they acclimated to the Western way of life. And I mean, my relatives came from England and
our relatives
came from England.
Because you and I are related.
That's right. Yours came from Germany. Mine came from England. Yeah. But they somehow they got
somewhere they got together a little bit.
They did.
Yeah.
But, you know, I suspect my relatives, they moved up into Wales and they came across and settled over in the Grace, Idaho area. And they probably brought a little of that British attitude with them.
Yeah. Somewhat. Well, you are kind of snobbish.
Well, just around you.
I've got a minute left.
I know. Well, we're pretty much done. You know, this was an interesting time in the history of the Old West. And I don't think a lot of us think about the Europeans.
How many of those families are still in the Intermountain West today?
Oh, I'm going to guess there's thousands.
Wouldn't it be neat to try to do some tracing and find out if we could get a great-great-grandson or something?
Yeah, somebody that traces it back to even royalty of some kind back in England. And how did they manage to get here, and what did they do when they got here?
Yeah.
So
pip, pip, cheerio.
And it's to me, a fascinating part of the settling of the Old West.
Absolutely. So you're from Wales.
Well, no, England. There's a little town in England called Bovey Tracy. My great-grandfather moved up into Wales when he was 5, and at age 11 went to work in a coal mine in Wales at age 11.
That's right. Thus the book.
Yes.
Yes. Dr. History did it again, and always very interesting, every Tuesday right here.